Buddha's descent into Sri Lanka, the Buddha's manifestation in Sri Lanka, Buddha's entering into Sri Lanka. Right at the beginning of the sutra, the title implies some relationship of the Buddha to the place that he is, which happens to be Sri Lanka in this case. Entering into it completely, so there's no separation. Being completely here and now in one's location, with no separation between oneself and the place, is maybe a loose interpretation of avatara, the Lanka Avatara Sutra. And to dive right in to the sutra today, does anyone need a copy? I have just a few here. So please, if you have one this time, you either give it back to me at the end or bring it next week so we don't make a new copy for people each week. All right, there's just three right now. You can listen along if you don't have. And just to review a little bit, I think I said at the beginning of last class that the whole purpose of all of Buddha's teachings, including this mind-only system and the Lankavatara Sutra and all these Dharma discussions, is to understand how things work, how the mind works more and more clearly, so as to relieve the suffering of ourselves and others. And one little online discussion arose about suffering and whether that's, you know, too big a thing to say, that, well, we might not feel like we're really suffering. That's a big word. So just to clarify that we all have discontent sometimes or another. Sometimes we're really suffering, but even if we feel like we're generally happy people and we're doing okay, still, I think often the reason we come to practice is, sometimes at least, we're not completely content with our lives, or maybe we could even say we're not like fully alive, we're not fully like settled into our place here and now, and thriving in this amazing gift of life. And so maybe we don't call that suffering if we're just like not completely thriving. But this, you know, not complete thriving is, you could say, all these teachings address that. The potential that we have for complete thriving and being more than just getting by in the midst of a difficult life, but actually free from all doubt, discontent, and sense of separation between ourselves and the world, between ourselves and all beings. So maybe it's an idealistic tradition we have, but that it offers this possibility. I trust that to be completely free, and of course in the Mahayana, the great vehicle, it's not just so we can step out of all discontent and be free and forget all these beings that are having difficulty, but so that we can, within our non-separation from them, help everyone in the most intimate way to be completely free and thrive in their moment-to-moment life. So as we get into all the details, as always, let's remember this basic context. That's the whole point. And as it gets really detailed, you might figure, like, well, what's this got to do with that point? And if you feel that, let's bring it up and question whether it does have to do with that point. I would propose most of it does. This is a sutra that doesn't get too sidetracked in extraneous issues, I don't think. So in chapter 2 here, Mahamati's questions, this bodhisattva, Mahasattva, this enlightening being, bodhisattva, working for the benefit of all beings, on the path to Buddhahood. Mahamati, great intelligence, bodhisattva, asks the Buddha. Now, I'm not sure exactly what page this is, but this is one sentence here where he just says, Mahamati asks the Buddha, Bhagavan, in how many ways do the various forms of consciousness arise, persist, and cease? And I just included that because that's the main thing that the Buddha is going to start talking about now. So, responding to this question of Mahamati Bodhisattva. And now we have this section 7 on page 71 in the Red Pine version. Very nicely, the Red Pine numbered these sections using the same division of the sutra that D.T. Suzuki used, so that we can compare. If you have the other translation, you can. It's section 7 in the Roman numerals. The original Sanskrit and Chinese actually don't have these different section breakdowns. It was a later, I think, a Japanese practitioner from a while back who said, there's so much scattered stuff and it jumps around so much, let's try to break the sutra into these sections to give it a little more sense. So there are other monks and priests, Mahamati, who see things. Do you see that part? Somewhere on page 71, if you want to follow. Who see things, and this is like talking about, first he's, as I recall, he's kind of criticizing some practitioners who go down various sidetracks, and now he's praising these other monks and priests, shramanas and brahmanas, Mahamati, who see things as devoid of self-existence, svabhava. Now this next paragraph and this whole section here is a kind of summary of, in some ways you could say, of the whole Mahayana path, but particularly according to Yogacara. And it's not going to get into too many details. It's more, at this point, setting out this whole vast path to Buddhahood as a kind of context. Yeah. And a lot of it would be true for all Mahayana great vehicle Buddhist teachings, not just mind only. So, for example, these monks and priests who see things as devoid of self-existence, or as empty of svabhava, this is the basic teaching of the Heart Sutra. Emptiness of self-existence, svabhava, or own being is another translation. The Heart Sutra, the version that we chant from the Chinese right now, says something like, at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, practicing deeply Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, clearly saw that all five skandhas, aggregates, so in brief we could say body and mind, all our experiences of body and mind are empty and were saved from all suffering. All discontent, all non-thriving, when seeing that body and mind, and basically we could expand that to the whole world. We're not going to get into the five aggregates right now, but seeing all these things as empty was saved from all suffering. Now, the original Sanskrit of the Heart Sutra says, Avalokiteshvara clearly saw that all the five aggregates, all body and mind, is empty of svabhava, empty of self-existence, or empty of own being, and thus relieved all suffering. So that's what we mean when we say seeing emptiness and being free from all suffering means that all our experiences of body and mind, expanded in Buddhist psychological terms as the five aggregates, are empty of self-existence, means they don't exist on their own. This is the basic emptiness teachings of the Prajnaparamita and so on, which is not the main focus here, but it's being mentioned. So there's these, some of these people see things, dharmas, phenomena, everything, as devoid or empty of self-existence. And then some metaphors for what that's like clouds in the sky. So the vast sky, open sky of emptiness, all things are like these ever-changing, dissolving clouds that are never the same for a moment and just actually just vapor in the air anyway. But some of those big puffy clouds look like they're really animals and shapes and different things up there, but actually they just dissolve back into the sky. Or wheels of fire, and that's like, you know, when you take a at night, like a torch with a light on the end or a flashlight, and you swing it around, and instead of just one light moving around, it becomes actually a circle or a wheel of light, wheel of fire. So it looks like a round circle, but that's an illusion, right? It's an optical illusion. So things are like this. All things are like clouds in the sky, like a wheel of fire, when it's not really a wheel there, but it looks like a wheel. Or cities of Gandharvas. These are these classic Indian metaphors for these emptiness teachings. Gandharvas are these celestial musicians, and that they're in between lives, some Buddhists would say, people abide temporarily in this Gandharva being state in between lives, and they're I think Red Pine maybe says this, is that they're Gandharvas. It's to get one of these, you know, celestial beings of Buddhist pantheon, right? They're also they're the guardians of soma. Soma is like the food of the gods in the Vedas, pre-Buddhist Vedas, and many people have researched this and think that actually they're talking about psychedelic mushrooms was actually the soma of the Vedas. So it's interesting that these Gandharvas are the guardians of soma. So the cities of Gandharvas are like the, you could say, are these like whole vast cities of people and buildings and things that are like illusory hallucinations in space. But it's one of the classical images, cities of Gandharvas. Like, they're like magic, they're actually appearing. They really appear, but they're like, you could put your hand through them. And as not arising, as illusions or mirages, similar to a mirage, right? You see water, a lake in the desert, and then you go up to it, it's not really there. Or dreams, great classic Yogacara image. Dreams seem totally real when they're happening, but when we wake up, they didn't. But they really did appear. It's just that they don't really exist as such. Or moonlight on the water. Dogen Zenji, of course, uses that image too. The moon reflected in the water. When the water's very still, it looks like the actual moon there, but it's just a reflection. So there's a whole string of kind of Each one of these metaphors is a great image for how things are. They're just metaphors, but they're nice and varied. They have a whole bunch of different metaphors for how this world is. It's like the moon reflected in the water. It's like a fire ring when swirling a torch. In the sense that all these things really do appear. That's an important point. They really do, we don't deny that they appear, but they really don't exist in like an inherently existent way. They're mere appearances. And all the emptiness teachings point to this. In fact, we could say this is the two truths. There's two levels of reality. Conventional truth is all these appearances of the world, and we don't deny conventional truth. But conventional truth is actually like a mirage. It's a mere appearance. It doesn't truly exist. And then the ultimate truth is everything is empty of self-existence. That emptiness is the ultimate truth. Or in the Yogacara mind-only view, it's emphasizing, we could say emptiness is the ultimate truth, but mind-only is emphasizing more that non-duality is the ultimate truth. There's no separation between mind and the world, or mind and objects. But we could say conventional is the same in both. Just the appearance of things is conventional truth, or the appearance of things outside the mind, or a dualistic setup. The fact that I'm here and you're over there, that's an illusory appearance called the conventional truth. So this is just kind of like, you know, Mahayana overview here with a bunch of beautiful classic metaphors. Regardless of whether they appear to be inside or outside the mind, so there's this, these practitioners see things as empty of self-existence, like all these images, and regardless of whether they appear to be inside or outside the mind, as projections. They see them as projections. This term vikalpa is related to parikalpa and so on, which is an important Yogacara term that's going to come up later, so let's skip over it now. They regard them as projections from the beginningless past and as not existing apart from one's own mind. So now this is, now we're kind of narrowing in on mind only. They see these things as devoid of, empty of self-existence and as not existing apart from one's own mind. And when the causes of such projections cease and the repository consciousness, alaya vijnana, repository or storehouse consciousness, becomes free from projections of a body, its possessions, and the world around it. So we're going to have a little list of different dualistic separations here. Like we have, here's me, this body, and then this book is my possession. My meaning like this body's possession is maybe one way to look at it. And the world around it is also my world. And my is referring to the mind or the body. Well, in this case, it just looks like it's just saying briefly and simply that this alaya vijnana becomes free from the projections of a body and its possessions, we could say including the world around it, and from what speaks and what is spoken, the speaker and what is spoken, another like dualism, from what sees and what is seen, and accordingly see what grasps and what is grasped. All of these are different versions of, you know, the eye grasping a color, you could even say. These are all versions of basically the grasper and the grasped. So when this storehouse consciousness becomes free from and sees what's grasps, what grasps and what's grasped as no longer interacting in the realm of consciousness, and whatever the mind gives rise to as existing in a projection-free realm devoid of origination, duration, and cessation. That's a long sentence. Yeah, and if you're not reading along, it might be hard to have caught that whole thing. Let's maybe summarize it and kind of break out the middle parts a little bit and just say, when the causes of dualistic projections cease, this repository consciousness becomes free from all dualities, and then at that time, that practitioner sees that the grasper and the grasped no longer interact in the way we usually think they do in the realm of consciousness. And then they also see whatever the mind gives rise to, like the mind is giving rise to an image and a concept of a book that actually exists in a projection-free realm. That the mind's giving rise to this book, but this book exists in a projection-free realm devoid of, or empty of, origination, duration, and cessation. Like this book, we actually think, arose and lasts, has a duration for hopefully a while, maybe 100 years, maybe a few 100 years, and then eventually the paper will just get eaten by termites and stuff, and it will cease. We think that this book out here is like that, but actually the way this is, what's out here is in this projection-free realm that actually doesn't arise, last, or cease. It's beyond all those concepts. It's inconceivable. This projection-free realm, we could call like Buddha mind is a projection-free realm. It means there's no projections of duality, like things that arise and cease. So can you kind of follow so far? This is again just like this, it's kind of laying out this path, and path to realization and what happens, you know. People start meditating on how external things are like projections of mind, and by seeing how this works, then the storehouse consciousness, that's the source of all the projections, stops giving rise to projections. We'll talk about that in detail soon. And that then what seems to be out there as projected images is seen as this projection-free, like, reality realm. Yes?
Is projection a synonym for imputation?
Yes. Yeah. So Red Pine uses this word projection. Some of us are familiar with the word imputation, or imagination is another one. And then there's all these similar Sanskrit words like that all have the word kalp in the middle, and kalp means like to project, imagine, or impute. And then vikalpa, v you might have heard, means like just like the word English word divide, v means to split. So vikalpa is like just emphasizing this imagination is like divides things into a world. Parikalpita is how we translate the what we call the imputational nature or character. Pari means completely, so it's like the completely imagined, completely projected character of things. While we're on that, just see some other synonyms for vikalpa and kalpana and parikalpa. Projection is constructing, forming, manufacturing, inventing, creating in the mind, forming in imagination, assuming to be real, feigning, you know, like kind of faking, feigning something, fiction, or imagining, or projecting. And one commentator says that actually to translate this as just thought or conceptual thinking, which we might say, isn't that what we mean by just conceptual thinking? He says that's actually too narrow to translate it as just conceptual thought or thinking, because it's actually everything that goes on in a dualistic mind, conscious or unconscious, such as, for example, non-conceptual imagination of outer, external objects. And I remember we had this discussion in one other class about, is there a difference between non-conceptual and non-dual? They're very, very similar, but it seems like this realm of complete projectionlessness would be like the realm of complete non-duality. And it's that particular commentator seems to imply that there can be a non-conceptual imagination of an external world. And what that might be like, we might say, well, what would that be? The way I would understand this is just a very, very subtle, maybe even in deep meditation is how we might experience this kind of thing. Like maybe samadhi, or at least a very deep, settled meditation where we're really, there's not much conceptual thinking going on, but there's still this slight sense of like, I'm a meditator, and there's a world that I'm sitting in, for example. Yes?
So I was reminded of a movie decades ago, All the Gods Must Be Crazy, where a Coke bottle falls out of an airplane and lands in the middle of a place where people don't read or write, and they've never seen a Coke bottle. So the first time they see it, it's kind of like, am I wrong, non-conceptual seeing. Then they begin to impute all kinds of powers to the Coke bottle, and their whole civilization falls apart as a result of that. So, are we talking about seeing something prior to thematizing it?
Well, that's an interesting example. I would, my take on this at present time is that that example would be, there's not much conceptualization about the Coke bottle at first. They really don't know what it is, but there's still, it's like an object. It's still an external object, like other rocks and things that they pick up. They don't know what it is, but that's still a concept. If they don't have a name for it, but it's a thing, whatever, in their language or in their way of thinking, it's still a physical phenomena. And then, of course, yeah, this realm of projection and imagination can get more and more expanded, as we know, to it's not just a Coke bottle, it's a special gift from the gods, and then let's start fighting over it, and then, as I recall, it's a great movie about, yeah, projections and imaginations. Eventually, it's this great thing becomes like this big problem that we have to get rid of it because it's destroying our whole community due to projections and imaginations. Another example like that would be like things like that it plays out an example how our thriving in daily life could be hindered by projections is like prejudice. You know, like we hear that maybe some certain race of people is like maybe dangerous or something, and we should be, we hear from our parents or someone some friend, like, be careful of those kind of people. And we've never met those people, but then we come across them and they haven't done anything dangerous or wrong, but we see them and we're immediately like scared and suspicious. And I think this is like racism and prejudice, right? How it works. So almost unconsciously, we're not trying to do that even, but because we've not only do we personally create imaginations, but collectively as societies, we create all these projections and imaginations, and believe in them. We see like the torch. We really think it is a ring of fire, and of course these again are like kind of grosser projections. You know, we could say that the sutra and these kind of teachings are getting into the really basic building blocks of projection. Like, just we see a person of a certain race, and even before that, we see them as a person. And maybe if it's at night and we can't quite see it, the shape in the dark, we don't even know it's a person, but it's still an external object, a shadow in the dark. So there's still a kind of projection, even before they're a person. Yes?
So all projection is considered bad, or just some
projection? Well, we didn't use the word bad so far here, but... and I don't know if the sutra ever says bad exactly, but it would say that all projection, even the projection of like that this is outside my mind, is not exactly bad, but the source of discontent and the source of not being fully our full capacity as bodhisattvas has not been realized if we think like that, yeah.
Can self-projections be a survival benefit?
Yeah, and in fact, that's how they come to be. Probably all projections originally start as, yeah, basic survival mechanism. The mind, and this is not something, again, it's like, as we get into this, we'll see, this is not about like just how we turning off our projections or stopping projecting. We can't just like decide to do that. So it's a natural human capacity that we all have and we all do basically continuously. I think according to these teachings that even in dreams we're projecting, maybe very, very deep dreamless sleep, we'd have a small break from this projecting realm. But all waking life is you know, continuous, nonstop projection, according to how we're defining it here, or imagination. And it is, yeah, it's survival. Like if we don't see like this food as out here, and we have to put it into here, then we're gonna starve. So it looks like originally, I mean, I don't know. We can tell different stories about evolution, and we could bring in. Science and biology and things like this to say, well, how did this start? We don't really know how it started, but it looks like there was some advantage to different species being able to see other like things that are going to eat them as out there, and we should run away from them, and other things that we're going to eat as out there, we're going to eat them. And that dualistic split is like, in a way, it's helpful. We've evolved. All sentient beings on the planet seem to do this. So if we believe in survival of the fittest, it seems like the trait of projection is very useful for survival.
So you could say we inherited that.
Yeah.
But then are we saying that I'm not familiar with the terms, the original mind or natural mind, it doesn't have that.
Original mind, I mean, we haven't used that term, but we could say, Buddha's mind doesn't have that, yeah. But it's not so much that, like, there was, I mean, we could tell different stories here. One would be, I guess the story I would tell now is that there wasn't, like, originally a Buddha, and then Buddha started projecting. It's more like... Buddha doesn't tell so many stories about how in the distant past this came to be, but it's more like from beginning, we say beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. This delusion of separation is beginningless, so we don't even get into how it originated, and we say there's a potential to be completely free of that. Like Buddha's mind is completely free of that. Whether there was a mind that was free of that before it happened, or whether it happened and then some body like a Buddha, discovered that one could be free of that, that a sentient being could actually be free of that. Like Buddhas, we say Buddhas are just a response to sentient beings. So I would see it more as like, it wasn't like first there were Buddhas and then sentient beings evolved. I would say first sentient beings evolved, and then at a certain point, sentient beings realized what a sentient being is, and that, and kind of in a way evolve beyond a sentient being, we might say, to a Buddha. Yeah, like projections eventually cease for a Buddha. And, you know, as we go through this story here, it's like this, it's almost like a pep talk. It's like early on in the sutra here, it's like, here's this whole path to complete Buddhahood. And we might hear this and be like, whoa, this is way beyond me. This is like, how is this going to help in my daily life? Because, like, this is too much. I can't do this path it's talking about here. But, as I say, like a kind of encouragement or like, here's what's possible. And then all these teachings about, you know, everything leading up to that point are incredibly useful before Buddhahood. Like, there's maybe very few fully realized Buddhas in the world. But anyone, bodhisattvas on that path are very beneficial. Like, they might not have ceased projections, but they're really studying their projections very more and more diligently and seeing more and more how what they believed was true was actually a projection. And even though they don't end, that relationship to projections could change and they could become more and more free, just like us. We can, you know, like just the example of like racism, we could say like, we see the person that we heard about being dangerous and we feel this fear, we can catch that and be like, oh, wait a second. Really? Why am I afraid? Is that just an imagination or projection that is unnecessary in this case and actually harmful to my relationship with that person? So there's many, many degrees of depth and from beginning to end, as far as we want to go with it, it's available. And the sutra presents like the furthest reaches right here. I think this is a section where he's going... He's like giving the all the way version in a couple paragraphs. So we're at, they see that this storehouse consciousness becomes free from projections of duality. And then to this next paragraph, Mahamati, such bodhisattvas, soon realize the identity of samsara and nirvana. That's a radical statement. Now, I think a lot of people have heard about Buddhism, these two terms. They usually present it as like opposites. Samsara is like the cycle of rebirths driven by greed, hate, and delusion. Whether you believe in multiple births or not, just say in samsaras, we're cycling through every day, every moment we're cycling through our life of greed, hate, and delusion, driven by our habits, our karmic habits, uncontrollably, and giving rise to discontent and non-thriving over and over. So that's samsara, you know, in early Buddhism. The goal is to end this cycle of birth and death, to end samsara, this driven cycle. And nirvana is, you know, the end of samsara. It's like the opposite. Nirvana is the peace that's left when the greed, hate, and delusion are abandoned. And that's a nice, simple definition of nirvana that the Buddha uses in the early sutras. It's the end of greed, hate, and delusion. Particularly in this case, we could say that even these subtle delusions of an external world. But here, these bodhisattvas, soon. I don't know what he means by soon. Soon might be like several eons. But they, bodhisattvas on this path, realize the identity of samsara and nirvana. So this kind of thing you don't hear in the early teachings. This is quintessential great vehicle, Mahayana teaching, the identity of samsara and nirvana. Dangerous teaching in a way, because greed, hate, and delusion are perfect freedom, Buddhahood, just as they are. We have to be careful with this kind of thing, right? But the Mahayana does say this.
Mm-hmm. So the Mahabodhisattva is one who has liberated from the tyranny of imputations, and thereby, as skillful means, can enter empathetically into the imputations of another person, and through compassion, help them to be liberated from their imputations.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. And that you can make a connection there too. They realize nirvana, the freedom from projections, but then they can enter into samsara.
That's right. So samsara and nirvana are identical.
Yeah. To yeah. Like because we could even say, maybe we could even in a mind only version, we could translate this as projections themselves are just like mirages. And if we see that, rather than just ending them, we can live in a projected world in order to help beings there.
Right. So Mahabodhisattva does not offer an alternative imputation, but enters in fully the imputation of the other person to help them. Mm-hmm.
They might offer alternative ones too.
Yeah.
Like, hey, here's six paramitas you can practice.
Skillful means.
It's more imputations, actually. Six paramitas are imputations.
Okay.
And bodhisattva precepts, and there's some great imputations we have. Daily zazen, chanting, ceremonies. We offer many imaginary practices you can come here and do. And they're not separate from non-imaginary practices. That's the amazing. So right there in zazen, you know, sitting in this posture, my legs are hurting. It's just a form, right? Do I have to, you know, is this projection-free realm? Like, I have to abide in this painful body? It's like, but a lot of Zen teachings are about this particular physical posture, just an imagination thing, is itself complete projection-free Buddhahood. A lot of the Zen teachings get into these, you know, samsara and nirvana, not too. So, and there's a lot of parts in the sutra that are just really just giving these just wonderful kind of summaries of Mahayana teachings, and like this are included in here. They realize the identity of samsara and nirvana with effortless compassion. Effortless compassion means like it's just natural. At that point, if samsara and nirvana are two, then their compassion is just free-flowing, uncontrived, natural, effortless compassion and skillful means, just as we were talking about, Mahamati, they view the realms of all beings as illusions and not subject to causation. So we might think, is viewing the realms of all beings as illusions, does that sound like compassion and skillful means? So there's a little koan in there. Yeah. Yeah, these beings are not who we think they are. And the more we can see that, the more skillful and compassionate we can be with them. Yeah. Transcending internal and external realms and seeing nothing outside the mind, they accordingly proceed from one stage to the next in samadhis that are free from appearances. So transcending, say that's letting go of the belief in internal and external realms. So we say that we all this talk about the external world, but if we have a version of an internal world, if we think mind is in here and the world's out there, that's another projection. This mind that we're talking about, like even alaya vijnana, is not like inside. It's not like the brain in the top of the head or something. It's non-locatable. It's maybe helpful at first to think that things are not out there. I had this ongoing debate with this friend of mine once. He's like, the mind-only thing, it seems so simple. You just see that, like, everything out there is really in here. And I kept saying, well, it's not really that it's in here. What do you say? You mean, like, in the brain? And he's like, not really, but, like, isn't it, because we think it's out there, it's helpful to say it's in here. The kingdom of God is within, we might say. But actually, maybe that's a skillful means. And I think that's what he said, is like, well, it's just a meditation, a temporary meditation to, like, become less obsessed with externality. And my point was more that internal realm is also another projection. It's almost the same thing as external. That's the setup of duality, whereas non-duality is not like everything is just inside or everything's just outside. It's like it's non-locatable. Yeah.
And also not subject to causation.
Let's see.
They view the realms of all beings.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a lot of, like, you know, stuff packed in here. So ultimate truth, this realm of non-duality and ultimate truth, is the realm of no arising and ceasing, no birth and death. The conventional truth of appearances is the world of arising and ceasing. And causation, arising and ceasing is another way of talking about causation, right? So in this ultimate truth of non-duality, there's no causation. And we could say causation is actually a very useful and accurate, in the realm of conventional truth, way of describing the world. Cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Karma. Karma's kind of a subset of cause and effect, and then big cause and effect includes things other than karma. Is like personal intention, the effects of personal intentions as causes, but cause and effect would also include, like, leaves falling from trees are not karmic events, but it is an effect of a cause when a leaf falls from a tree. So causality. Even we could say dependent co-arising is the biggest version of causality. And so that's a big statement to say that in this projection-free realm, nothing inside and outside. Where everything is mere illusion. Things are truly, ultimately, not subject to causation. So dependent co-arising, we could say, is actually like the supreme conventional truth. That things, the realm of cause and effect, is not actually the ultimate truth. And I know we've had this discussion in various classes too, because sometimes we just equate, we say, well, isn't dependent co-arising itself the ultimate truth? But actually, my understanding is that that's like the conventional truth of arising and ceasing, and in this interdependence of all things is like the is not really the ultimate truth, but it's right there with the ultimate truth. The way we actually see or open to the ultimate truth is through meditating on dependent co-arising, or like seeing that, this is more like in this Madhyamaka middle way reasoning. We say because things are dependent on other things, they're empty of self-existence. And that emptiness of self-existence is the ultimate truth. So it's because of the conventional truth that there's the ultimate truth, we might even say. So, not subject to causation. Again, we have to make sure we're on clarifying which level we're on, because obviously there is causation, and it's the Buddha said you really have to understand how karma works and how cause and effect works and how wholesome actions lead to good results and so on. The Buddha taught this over and over again and said that ultimately, in the end, it's not really like that. But if you skip that and say, like, well, let's just go right to the ultimate truth, that's impossible. You have to be, like Nagarjuna says, you have to be thoroughly grounded in the conventional truth in order to realize the ultimate truth. You can't skip over. And even then, if realizing the ultimate truth, this is this identity of samsara and nirvana, you have to live in this world, right? In the world of cause and effect, and with skillful means, help the beings of this world in the world of causality. Transcending internal and external realms and seeing nothing outside the mind, they accordingly proceed from one stage to the next in samadhis, free from appearances. And this is referring to this topic of these 10 bodhisattva bhumis, or stages, which we don't talk about here much, because Zen is a tradition that's really into, like, not falling into stages. It's part of the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva stages. Each stage, we could say that basically, I mean, it's a whole topic for a whole other class, right? But it's like letting go of finer and finer delusions, more and more subtle delusions, progressing through the stages to Buddhahood. You know, these 10 Bodhisattva stages, and then like the 11th is like the Buddha stage. And I think Zen doesn't emphasize that because it's into, like, really into the non-duality. So it's like, well, if you say there's this stage and this stage, it's kind of making unnecessary distinctions. This is be Buddha right now. Easy, right? But it's nice to know about these bodhisattva stages, and the sutra presents it. They progress through these stages, and in samadhis, or, you know, absorption, meditative concentrations that are free from appearances. And upon examining the three realms, this is basically everything. We could say samsara, sometimes talked about as the three realms of experience. Finding them illusory, they attain the samadhi of the illusory. And maybe it's worth mentioning that, you know, the three realms are kind of like emphasizing meditational realms. There's like the, we live basically almost all the time in the desire realm, the kama loka, which is just like where we're basically being pushed and pulled by desires a lot. And then there's the form realm and the formless realm, which are both like entered through meditative absorption, dhyana, Zen, old version of Zen practice. There's the form samadhi, the form dhyanas, and the formless dhyanas, and so they're like where there's less and less separation. But I say it's worth mentioning because even in the so-called formless realm, is one of the three realms, that's still considered to be samsara. Even in the early teachings, the Buddha said, this nirvana is free of these three realms, free of even these very deep, like the sphere of infinite space, for example, is one of the names of these dhyanas, but that's still samsara. Sorry to say. Very, very, Buddha had a very high standard for nirvana. Examining the three realms, finding them illusory. So like the sphere of infinite space and infinite consciousness, they're really actually illusory in the end. They attain the samadhi of the illusory, which is like some particular concentration state where everything is seen as illusory. We could call it like a mind-only samadhi. And once the perceptions of their own minds are free from projections, they're able to dwell in the perfection of wisdom, prajna paramita. I thought that was just so nice that this Lankavatara Sutra includes the term prajna paramita from the Prajna Paramita Sutras.
So what's the projection are free, or the perceptions are free from projection?
Yeah.
How come you can't just go, and once they're
they are free from projection.
I think you could say that too. But this is where we're going to get into like how perception works and that, you know, consciousness and how we perceive our world is infused with all these projections. So we could maybe even say once consciousness, the perceptions of their mind, like all the different types of consciousness are free of projections. They're able to dwell in the perfection of wisdom and to let go of their life and their practice and to enter the diamond samadhi that accompanies a Tathagata's body and that accompanies the transformation of suchness. Ta-ta-ta. Let go of their life. We say, like, drop off body and mind, right? Like, from a mind-only point of view, we could say drop off body and mind is like let go of all the projections about body and mind. And all the projections about our practice. I think that's nice that they put that in there. Let go of their life and their practice. So at this point, these bodhisattvas are no longer like, I should do some practice today. I think they're far beyond that kind of like realm. It's like they let go of all the ideas about their body and mind and all the ideas about their bodhisattva practice. They're just coursing in prajnaparamita effortlessly. Thus endowed with higher powers and masteries as well as compassion and skillful means. Always, as it sounds more and more exalted, it's always including compassion and skillful means for the beings of this world. They enter the sanctuaries of other paths in every Buddha land. They can travel to distant realms where other Buddhas practice and receive teachings from other Buddhas in different world systems and so on. And transcending the mind, and I think this might, transcending here might be this term, paraviti, transformation, or transcending, overturning, which we'll get into as this goes on. Transcending the mind, the will, and conceptual consciousness. These bodhisattvas gradually transform their body into the body of a Tathagata. Therefore, Mahamati, those who seek the body that accompanies a Tathagata, a Buddha, should avoid the fabricated projections of origination, duration, or cessation regarding the skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas, consciousness, causation, or forms of practice. So a bunch of terms, a bunch of Sanskrit stuff going on. But basically, this last part about the projections of, you know, the arising, origination, the duration, and the cessation regarding the five skandhas of body and mind. The dhatus and ayatanas are other versions of the five skandhas. They're basically, well, actually, they're here. This is maybe what we get into now. That the 18 dhatus, this is 18 dhatus, and the 12 ayatanas are, if you take out the middle column, you have these six faculties and these six objects are called the ayatanas. But it's just classic Buddhist psychology lists, and they're saying that we're not having fabricated projections of arising and ceasing on any of this stuff on this chart that we're about to go into. And then so before that, transcending the mind, the will, and conceptual consciousness. So that's these terms. The mind, or citta here, is the same thing as alaya in the sutra and other sutras. When they're put as a list like this, mind, will, and conceptual consciousness is the 8th, 7th, and 6th consciousness. Or mind or citta is alaya. Will is Red Pine's translation of what we call manas. Or the intellect, thought, mentation, thinker is often translated. Mind, the mental faculty. And then mental mind consciousness is mind consciousness, mental consciousness. So this is a, now we can segue into this chart that the next section is going to go into these eight consciousnesses. They overturn, they transcend mind, thought, and consciousness. The eighth, seventh, and sixth consciousness. So that's a little summary of what's to come. So some of you might have seen this from a previous class. It's a map of the mind, or we could say of the person. This is like what a person is, according to mind only. Or the world. This is a map of the whole world, because in mind only, right? This is the mind is the world, or maybe we should say the world is the mind in mind only. So it's a map of the mind or the world, and it's the eight consciousnesses of the mind only school. So from early Buddhism on, you know, Buddha taught in the Pali Canon and so on, these six, right? Six sense faculties, six sense objects, and six sense consciousnesses. And again, like, so if you add together six, six, and six, that's the 18 dhatus. Dhatu means realm, 18 realms. And ayatana, I'm not sure how it translates exactly, but sometimes the Buddha just taught it as the six faculties and the six objects. And you often see that list together, the five skandhas, the 12 ayatanas, and the 18 dhatus is basic, just like the basic structure of Buddhist psychology and map of the mind through all different schools of Buddhism. There's a little, this alaya part, the storehouse, is unique to Yogacara, mind only, and the sutra. So this is sense organ. Other translations are the sense power, the sense gate, sense faculty, or sense sensitivity. Indriya is the word in Sanskrit, and actually Indra, you know, is the lord of the gods. Indriya is like a power, the powerful faculty, the ruler, you could even say, of a visual experience is the eye organ. And what we mean by organ is not the physical eyeball, or even like, it might be getting close to, like we talked about this thing about the retina, the rods and cones. It's like it's the sensitivity of the organ where color starts to get transformed into a consciousness. And again, this is where Yogacara gets really interesting, because however we deal with this issue, with science or with Buddhism and all these different schools, we have to deal with this issue of how so-called physical things, like colors, how like colors get transformed into a mental experience of a color. Basically, it's the mind-matter problem. If we say color is matter, and all the senses have it, sound is a physical thing, right? Waves in the air. Smell is like little molecules. It's physical stuff. But it, as we know, without any effort, as sentient beings, we experience this, the physical world mentally. And so we say, somehow the matter has to get, matter has to meet mind somehow. And this is a problem. If you start thinking about this, how is it, you know, well, mind can experience matter, but if you start looking really carefully about this, it's a problem. Like, how is that going to happen? How is it happening? Because it is happening. But how can we explain? How can we understand how, I mean, just to even start thinking about it is a kind of an interesting meditation. It starts to become like, wow, it becomes just an awesome thing that we can experience a world, right? So, and I personally feel like we'll get into this maybe later, but the Yogacara version deals with it in the most straightforward way, which you might think is a really weird way, and maybe it's got other problems, but the way it does it is saying, well, it basically just eliminates matter. It says matter is mind, actually. And it's the only, of all the schools of Buddhism, it's the only tradition that actually says that. And it actually very nicely deals with that. It says, you know, there's a way we actually have to project a mental image of matter to experience it. But it's all, you know, projections of mind. So we don't have that problem. The other schools have to come up with very elaborate explanations for how the mind can actually touch matter or experience matter. And they come up with some pretty weird things. So in some ways, this mind-only thing is kind of simpler than these earlier systems. And if you say, well, we don't have to explain that, it's too complicated, let's not think about it. Well, how does it happen, though? Anyway, so we have I, and then the object or field, Vishaya, is the color or shape. And then the consciousness kind of mediates between them. There's an I consciousness. So you might say, well, can't we just have one consciousness that experiences all this stuff? But from the early days, Buddha seemed to teach that each of the sense faculties has its own consciousness. And I think it's just to, because in a way you could say, especially in a non-mind-only version, you have an eye and a color, but you're not going to have an experience of color without something, some consciousness, right? We need a way to know it. So that kind of mediates between a physical faculty and a physical object in the non-mind-only versions. And you have same ear consciousness, sound, nose consciousness, smell, tongue consciousness, taste, body consciousness, touch. You know, that's just like any, that would include temperature is a body. You know, a touch, feeling warm would be a form of touch. So basically any physical experience is included in these five. And then we have the six. So mind, like a mind faculty, right? And then mind consciousness, mano vijnana. And then in the early system, they don't have a storehouse consciousness. There's just the object of mind consciousness is dharmas, phenomena. And then the dhatu system, right, it's called the dharma dhatu. These are all called, all 18 dhatus. The dharma dhatu is the realm of mental experience. And so we might say, and it makes sense that, you know, the mind thinks of phenomena, so we have that breakdown. We might start to question, well, what's the difference between a mind faculty and a mind consciousness? Aren't they kind of the same thing? I mean, it's just a mind that experiences objects. So we could say it's partly to complete the chart, you know, yeah, to have 18 dhatus. And there's some interesting ways that the Buddha breaks, you know, understands, like, what is this? What's the mental faculty? It's maybe easier to understand mind consciousness, just like these sense consciousnesses are, you know, directly experiencing. There's direct sensory experience of colors and sounds before mental consciousness kicks in. There's a direct sensory experience that's what these consciousnesses directly experience. Mind consciousness has both. There's a direct mental consciousness that goes along with, like, often explained as the moment after a sense consciousness, there's a direct mental consciousness with the same object. And some traditions say it's just like a moment. We don't experience it in a knowing way because it's a direct experience. And then immediately afterwards, there's another, you know, moment of mind consciousness that's conceptual. And that, so we have, like, you know, open my eyes. Bing! So there's an eye meets black color. And all this is just, you know, immediate, right? And there's an eye consciousness that receives that. The story is, there's the next moment is a mental consciousness that kind of transforms it into a mental experience, but still direct. And then there's the conceptual consciousness that, even in a very, very basic way, knows it's black. And before there's any words, like, I'm seeing black. It's like more basic than that. And then, of course, there's the words. Yeah.
So his thinking is now plant leans toward the sun, follows the sun. And mm-hmm. The sun goes down, its flower closes. So that's a form of consciousness. And so I'd say, is it too simplistic to say consciousness in this middle column is sort of like function of the organ?
I think we could say it's the function of an organ.
So the eye organ functions to make us aware of color and shape.
Yeah, yeah. The organ, the consciousness functions to make us aware of a visual experience. It makes it into a visual experience. By the way, I wouldn't say really that a plant's responding to the sun is technically a consciousness, though. I mean, according to this kind of thing. Partly because you can't, in this system, they always go together. Like, we talk about dependent co-arising. It's not that there's colors out there, and then an eye comes up and sees it, and then the consciousness comes. It's all three. The faculty, the object, and the consciousness dependently co-arise simultaneously. So in other words, part of what that implies is that you can't have an eye consciousness without color. Like, it's, you could say there's the potential for it. The potential is resting down here in the storehouse.
So does this schema then apply to all sentient beings?
Yeah, this is all sentient beings.
This defines sentient beings.
Yeah, and sentient wouldn't include plants, as far as we know.
But there's a non-sentient consciousness that's referring to, but yeah. We're fit into this schema. All sentient beings.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah, a map of all sentient beings, we could say. Now, like things like earthworms, you know, we don't know exactly, but my understanding would be, yeah, earthworm would have 18 dhatus. How wonderful. Especially if we get into, like, you know, the five skandhas might be harder to start locating in an earthworm. What's that?
Maybe the eye, but maybe they're sensitive to light. I don't know.
Yeah, so maybe not. Maybe they're just sensitive to light and sound. Actually, I don't really know. I haven't studied really primitive organisms.
I mean, if you find it, plus three of them right there.
Yeah, well, I think it'd still be light. Even if you're blind, I think you'd still see the difference between light and dark, right?
Depends on
blindness. Yeah. Yeah, so interesting.
The body responds to light and dark, like circadian rhythms, whether it's blind or not.
I know people have done these sleep studies, right, when they pitch black and people find their sleep rhythms, so maybe.
There is some organ that is, you know, kind of corresponds with the third eye.
Hmm. Pineal gland. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And another little story here is that talking about, well, what's going on with this, what's the mental faculty? Just to throw in here as part of the picture in the last few minutes. We'll spend more time on this in the future. In the early teachings, all schools of Buddhism agree that one way to talk about the mental faculty is it's the just deceased sense consciousness. Or maybe we could even say it's the previous moment of consciousness that just ceased. This is a weird thing, and maybe we shouldn't go too into it because we could spend a long time. But it's an interesting point of, like, to define, to work out the system in a really thorough way. It's like, what is the mental faculty? It's like, for example, you have, again, there's the color thing. You have, there's an eye consciousness. All these consciousnesses, by the way, are like momentary things. They're not like ongoing. They're a momentary experience. They cease. And the ceasing becomes The previous, we call it, there's different conditions for a new experience. One of the conditions is the previous moment is a condition for this moment. So the previous, we have a direct visual perception of black, and then that experience ceases, and then the next moment is a direct mental experience of the black color, and in this case, the mental faculty is the direct sensory eye consciousness that just ceased now becomes the mental faculty. That's something maybe you can think about over the next week. Why that would be.
The stand has ceased.
Chaos theorists would say it's the initial conditions. It's sensitive to initial conditions. The creation of new orders. And that initial condition would be the passing of the last moment.
Yeah. It's partly this thing of like every mental experience, this is talking about cause and effect and causality now, is that every mind experience has at least these three basic conditions of the, like a dominant condition, like it needs, the faculty functions as what's called the dominant condition for most experiences, and it has an object condition. So it needs the object, and it has the immediately antecedent or immediately preceding condition. And so partly because it needs that condition, partly because we need to define that condition for a mental experience. Well, what's going to be the previous moment of experience is the direct sensory experience for a mental experience, and we don't really have a mental organ, so they get lumped together. We say the mental faculty is both the immediately preceding condition. I mean, let's see, the mental faculty is the immediately preceding consciousness, and it's also the dominant condition.
So 1 through 5 produce data, 6 produces information.
Yeah, these produce direct data. Data and information sound pretty similar to me, but sensory data, and then information about the data, you could say. Maybe that's, what's that?
Knowledge.
Information
as opposed to data, raw data.
Kind of like in brain science, I mean, connecting that with past experiences, with
emotions. Sixth consciousness is a major player, and this sutra in particular says that this is the main thing we have to work with, is number 6. Mm-hmm. Now some other systems say 7th is the one we really have to work with. This is manas, and that actually, like Vasubandhu talks about how that manas gets afflicted by this view of self, becomes klishta manas. Klesha means like defilements or afflictions. It becomes afflicted by the sense of a self. So a sense of, as a particular yogacara thing here, that the mental faculty, we have to account for somehow the sense of a self. So they put it into like the mental faculty is like the one who thinks that they're thinking of things. It's all kind of tied up with a self. And we can talk about that more because it's quite an interesting thing that happens there. This stays the same in all of Buddhist schools, mental consciousness. Awareness, we could call it, you know, it's dualistic awareness, but it's also called cognition, discernment, or discrimination. And then lastly, the Dharmadhatu that was just all dharmas. In this system, you know, some people might draw this chart a little differently, but this is one way to work it, is that the object that we're actually seeing is the stuff of the storehouse consciousness, Alaya Vijnana, which is, here it says, the repository of karmic seeds, and which gives rise to the other seven consciousnesses. So that's why we have eight consciousnesses in Yogacara, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Seventh is the mind faculty, and eight is the storehouse consciousness. And then these arrows mean that actually all these consciousnesses, we could say all 17 other items on this list, all emerge out of the storehouse, and they do their activity in the world, and then that experience is then sinks back into the storehouse. So that's what's the relationship here. This is really like the ocean in this sutra, right? It's the ocean storehouse of Alaya, and all these other 17 items are like the waves arising on the surface, experiencing a world and like sinking back down and registering that experience, which is why we can remember our experience of the world from 20 years ago, because it's in here. And what is this anyway? We'll have to tune in next week to find out what is this thing here. And that all this stuff is set up as, it's kind of like a model, a map of the mind, but it's all set up to like, it's not exactly reality, right? It's just, it's a model. And but it's a model that's set up to dismantle itself, or like to understand how it works and become free. It's the model of how suffering arises. This is all we need for suffering. Just set up these 18 things, there will be suffering. and to become free from this mass of suffering, we need to map it out in some way or another. We can make simpler ones maybe, but since we have a few more weeks, let's get into this one. Yes.
Well, it seems to be that then liberation from suffering is hard.
It's pretty hard. Yeah. Well, one way to say...
And it hasn't been about completely transforming our Alaya Vijnana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
one story would be that what we think of as freedom from suffering, and we have, I think, all had times when we've been like, really seems completely free. One story would be like, that is very free, but this goes beyond, this freedom is even more free. that's not completely, it hasn't completely let go of the slightest traces of complete thriving, we might call. Yeah, we're not suffering, but we're like this complete non-dual embracing of reality. Yeah, well, in this early, kind of in the sutra model, we could say that like complete Buddhahood is, you can't really experience until complete Buddhahood. But in Zen tradition, and other traditions too, we can base our understanding on a sutra like this and say that we can actually glimpse these moments of complete non-projection. You know, one way that sometimes we talk about it would be like is that actually the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, for example, the path of seeing directly? And then I'd say, well, according to like a sutra model, we'd say no, because that first Bodhisattva Bhumi has to be like really, really steady and really, really unwavering, firm realization of suchness, for example. And we have these little glimpses. And I'll go with the story that these little glimpses, and we have to check out these glimpses too, because if we're just really relaxed, that might not be a glimpse of suchness. But we have a glimpse of suchness that it's just very short. So we might not say that it's the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, but we'd say the content of it is actually Buddha's mind. Mm-hmm. We can glimpse Buddha's mind, but it's very, very unsteady. It's very shaky, right? So, but it's very wonderful to know that it's like, you know, it's like there's clouds all over. There's like Buddha's sun is shining and everything, right? And there's a little tiny peephole in the cloud, and we see like almost blinded by the light from the little peephole. And then, but then that's very different from like the clouds are completely gone and we're just in the radiance of Buddha's sun. So, may all beings be free from all projections, thriving completely in this life for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow.